2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 153, Mother Earth, Father Patriarchy, Embracing a Mythology of Respect, Equality, and Harmony. A paper presented by Jennifer Chandler Jones with a response by Carrie Schertz.
Okay, we'd like to welcome you to Session 153, Mother Earth, Father Patriarchy, Embracing a Mythology of Respect, Equality, and Harmony. Our presenter today is Jennifer Chandler Jones, who is from, as of the last couple of days, from Virginia. She just moved there from Michigan. She's a hypnotherapist with five kids, one granddaughter. She is passionate about the environment. She plays the harp and is the best mother, according to her assistant, in the world. She is assisted this afternoon by Pat Andrus, who's from Washington, and they've been friends and soulmates for the last 13 years or so, approximately. Our responder is Carrie Schertz, who's a professional artist with wood. He's the author of two books on scroll saw art and an avid outdoorsman. He loves to climb, has done some great climbs in Idaho, where he's from, and he's published several articles through Farms and Fair, so he's our daily mole from the other side, I guess, this afternoon. So my name is Brian Stye, and I'll turn the time over to Jennifer.
Thank you. Mother Earth, Father Patriarchy. This is Embracing a New Myth of Equality, Harmony, and Peace. One day in the Garden of Eden, Eve calls out to God, "Lord, I have a problem." "What's the problem, Eve?" "Well, I know you created me and provided this beautiful garden and all these wonderful animals and that comedic snake, but I'm just not happy." "Why is that, Eve?" came the reply from above. "Lord, I'm lonely, and I'm sick to death of apples." "Well, even in that case, I have a solution. I shall create a man for you." "What's a man, Lord?" "This man will be flawed, with many bad traits. He will revel in childish things. He will like to play with balls. He will throw them, kick them, and hit them with little sticks. He'll be a little vain and may give you a hard time, but he will be bigger and stronger than you, and he'll like to fix things. So he will be a big help. He won't be too smart, so you'll also need to give him some advice to think properly." "Sounds great," said Eve, with an ironically raised eyebrow. "What's the catch, Lord?" "Well, you can have him on one condition." "What's that, Lord?" "As I said, he'll be proud, arrogant, and self-admiring, so you'll have to let him believe that I made him first. Just remember, it's our little secret. You know, woman to woman." The creation myths that we embrace provide the worldview upon which we form our beliefs and ideology. These stories have a powerful and profound effect on and often define the rules and values of a society. "This is our starting point," writes cosmologist Brian Swinn, "the universe, solar system, and the earth. We begin by asking where we are. There is a desire in the human to know our origin, where we came from. It is as strong as the desire for water. It is necessary for us to know. Just as humanity has changed over the years, so too has its story of creation. Over the past five millennia, we have seen a transformation from a time when humans lived in relative peace with each other and had a deep reverence for the earth, to a time when earth, its resources, and all of life are being destroyed at an alarming rate. We have seen a change from a time of equality and balance among the sexes to a time when women have been demeaned and marginalized. We have seen a change from a goddess worship to a time where a female deity, if she exists at all, certainly is no longer apparent or relevant. Might a change in creation stories have influenced this transformation? In the Judeo-Christian world, we have inherited a creation story that has had a profound and lasting impact on much of the world for most of recorded history. It is a story that may have provided answers and been useful for some in its day, but embracing this myth as a true and literal creation story directly from God may no longer be serving in the best interest of humankind. Today, we find ourselves in need of a dramatic improvement in the treatment of our planet. We need a heightened respect for the feminine and a deeper concern for our human family. We need a mythology that speaks of harmony, peace, and equality. The purpose of this paper is to explore the impact of the biblical creation story and consider the need for a new cosmology. We will begin by looking at the human experience during the time of a goddess worship. Following this, we will examine the biblical creation story and explore its influence on the treatment of women in the earth. We will next briefly review the development of patriarchy, and finally we will explore the possibility of embracing a new creation story, a sacred narrative that could unite our planet as a world community, moving humankind toward a world of respect, equality, and peace. 8,000 years ago, a small colony of settlers first arrived on the Mediterranean island of Crete. As these immigrants developed their villages, they incorporated the beliefs and technology of the communities from which they originated. Theirs was an agrarian society with spiritual beliefs centered on the mother goddess. Over the next 4,000 years, these early people developed a society rich in art, technology, culture, language, architecture, and spirituality. Professor of psychology Alfred Morrow describes this community as the most complete acceptance of the grace of life the world has ever known. These early people embraced a spirituality centered on goddess worship, where existed a mysterious veneration for the feminine energy of the earth and the female. Equality existed among the sexes, and humans had a deep reverence for the planet. This was a society where tools were created to assist the community, not to destroy others, a time when humankind did not embrace the ideology of domination, power, and control. There is virtually no evidence of war for 4,000 years. It was a time when the creativity and resources of the village were used to support each other, create art, and strengthen community. Our planet was revered, and humans lived in harmony with each other and nature. With the archaeological discovery of Crete just over 100 years ago, scientists have uncovered a well-preserved Neolithic village that has shed enormous light on this early period of history. The society of Crete reflects the cultures and beliefs of the other agrarian Neolithic communities throughout the world. The Neolithic period began approximately 10,000 years ago. After 4 million years of gathering and hunting, humankind stopped roaming, settled down, and became domesticated. Discoveries from the earliest communities of Jericho, Hassuna, Catalhoyuk, Jarmo, Crete, and others in Central and South America have given us deep insight into the lives of these early people. What we find is two societies emerging: those that moved into the village life and embraced horticulture, and those that developed herding and lived a nomadic life. With the understanding of crop production, animal domestication, and the cycles of life, our ancient ancestors moved into a new era of consciousness, quite different than that of the Paleolithic era. During this period, we find an awareness of the fecundity of the earth, and with this, an increasing respect for the cycles of life, growth, and death. There came an understanding of the power of nature and the life-giving properties of the earth. This new awareness of humankind associated with the female life-giving energy. Mythologist Joseph Campbell writes, "The human woman gives birth just as the earth gives birth to the plants. She gives nourishment as the plants do. So women magic and earth magic are the same. They are related, and the personification of the energy that gives birth to the forms and nourishes forms is properly female." This new paradigm resulted in a feminine ethos, one of peace, equality, and harmony with nature. Recent archaeological evidence supports the theory that the ancient agricultural villages existing in the Neolithic period, some until approximately 3000 BCE, achieved a level of peace virtually unknown on our planet for the last five millennia. As renowned historian Thomas Berry writes, "The Neolithic village has been the exciting context of immense creativity. It was as peaceful a period as humans would ever know. We find little evidence of warfare instruments or fortification to the Bronze Age. Walls and weapons were the exception rather than the rule. What is highly significant is in that all of these communities, we find no evidence in artifacts or art of warriors, battles, slaves, cruelty, violence, or mighty rulers. It is also vividly apparent that this was the time of the worship of the goddess, a time where the feminine energy was unmistakably honored and revered. Found in virtually all Neolithic villages is a participation and interaction with humankind with spiritual forces. The great mother deity was expressed in the seasonal renewal and was everywhere prominent. Over 100,000 images and artifacts demonstrating the worship of the mother goddess have been uncovered from this time period. The most peaceful time in known history was during a period of the worship of the goddess and the embracing of the feminine ethos. It is vitally important to this discussion, however, to acknowledge the fact that during this time, anthropologists do not find a matriarchal society where women exerted power and control over men. While there was a worship of the goddess, there's an inequality and harmony among the sexes, neither sex dominating, subjugating, or ruling the other. in the Neolithic villages of 3,000 people, usually in one village, we see a partnership society. Ryan also writes, evidence indicates a generally unstratified and basically egalitarian society with no marked distinctions between either class or sex. We see no signs of inequality. We've had an understanding of both women and men using our unique human faculties to support and enhance life. In the social order, it was a period of community intimacy and apparent widespread sharing and decision-making. In most Neolithic villages, women were at their high moment in providing cultural, religious, and social leadership, since identity at this time was generally given in terms of matrilineal descent. Matrilineal descent describing a system whereby descent and inheritance were traced through the mother. Some scholars speculate this may be due to the fact that generally mates did not partner for life, so offspring would have been understood as the mother's lineage. It may also not yet have been understood that the male participated in the process of the creation of life. So, what happened? What happened to the Neolithic villages, the peaceful communities that worshipped the mother goddess and revered the earth? Eisler elaborates on the significance of this change. It was, she says, a change so great, indeed, that nothing else in all we know of human cultural evolution is comparable in magnitude. It is essential to note that there is no singular event that caused the disappearance of the Neolithic villages, nor is there a specific moment in history that can be identified when they vanished. The change occurred in different times and in different places throughout the world. Change is most often multifaceted and complex, but in all areas of the world where the Neolithic villages existed, there appears to have been a very similar transformation. Concurrent with the peaceful horticultural communities who had developed their spirituality around the earth and mother goddess, we find the nomadic herding tribal people who built their spirituality foundation on the male god of the sky. As nomadic people camped on the hills at night, the skies became the mystery from which answers came. They looked to the lights and movement in the sky for meaning, filling their world with awe. The heavens provided the answers for which they searched. While those that embraced the gifts of the earth found meaning in the creative aspects of the earth and the life-giving properties of creation, those that roamed the hills found their meaning in the rewards and punishments from the gods in the heaven, two very distinctive and very different ethos. While the movement away from nature religion is multifaceted, what we see in all cases throughout the world generally is a clash between the peaceful villages and the warring nomadic tribes. As the more peaceful horticulture societies had abundance, they were overtaken by the tougher herding societies who roamed the land. As gatherers and hunters, humans had no need to conquer because there was nothing to gain. When the resources of a particular area were expended, the family moved on because there were no possessions. Excess belongings would actually be burdensome. But as food became easily abundant through farming, the land became something to desire and acquire. While there was something to acquire and gain from overtaking others, war and domination began. Marie Jigambutis writes, "It is now possible to trace several migratory waves of the steppe pastoralists that swept across prehistoric Europe. Anthropologists identify three waves of these invasions of the villages from the nomadic people, each taking about 100 to 200 years, and all occurring between 4300 and 2800 BC. The invasions of the Semitic tribes occurring during the last wave of the invasions, which was around 3000 BCE. For several hundred years and throughout much of the world, the nomadic tribes had been invading and overtaking villages. It is the Semitic tribes, however, from which we find our legacy in the Judeo-Christian world. From the book of Genesis, we learn of the brutality of these tribal people. The Semitic invasions began in the 4th millennium BCE and became more and more devastating. Speaking of the city of Shechem, Campbell writes, "Overnight, the city is wiped out by these herding people who have suddenly appeared. The Semite invaders were hunters, and so the cultures are essentially animal-oriented. When you have hunters, you have killers, and when you have herders, you have killers, because they're always in movement, nomadic, coming into conflict with other peoples and conquering the areas into which they move. And these invasions bring in the warrior gods, thunderbolt hurlers like Zeus or Yahweh. As other nomadic tribes had done for over 1,000 years, the Semitic people were invading and destroying the world of the mother goddess, systems, and the nature religions. They imposed much of their way of life on those whom they conquered. Those whose ways of life was destroyed by their conquerors were compelled to embrace the gods of their new rulers. Spirituality moved from the goddess worship to that of the herder sky god. By the end of the 4th millennium BCE, we see a major shift from the dominant female deities to a dominance of the male. Describing the depth of loss humans have experienced as a result of this nature religions being destroyed, historian Thomas Berry writes, the transition from female to male deity, from goddess to god, can now be recognized as one of the more portentous transitions that have ever taken place in human affairs. Just as culture changes and evolves and grows, so too does its stories and legends. We can learn an enormous amount of information about a culture or a people by understanding their myths and beliefs, particularly their stories of creation. Creation stories form the foundational beliefs within a culture. These stories are that upon which worldviews are based. Berry writes, in an earlier phase of human development, creation mythologies provided the basic context for personal and social existence. In accord with these great mythic statements, the various cultures are established. Speaking of the creation stories, Professor of History Gerda Lerner writes, by articulating how things were in the beginning, people make a basic statement about their relationship with nature and about their perception of the source of power in the universe. Creation myths not only provide the foundational beliefs for those who embrace the stories, they also reflect the belief of their creators. These stories are intimately bound to the culture, society, and time of their creators. Joseph Campbell writes, every mythology has to do with the wisdom of life as related to a specific culture at a specific time. It integrates the individual into his society and society into the field of nature. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, we have inherited a creation story that reflects the ideology and culture that existed 4,000 years ago. We have embraced the story and beliefs of those early Semitic nomadic tribes who imposed their life on the people they conquered. The Old Testament stories are likewise founded on the customs, ideals, and beliefs of those that lived during the 4th millennia BCE. Based on recent archaeological evidence, it is clear that the Pentateuch clearly reflects the beliefs of the people in the time that it was developed. As all myth responds to its creators, the Genesis creation story came out of a culture that embraced an ideology in which men have power and authority over women and the earth. These beliefs mirror those of the nomadic tribal people. The creation story in Genesis reflects the attitudes of the warring men who invaded the Neolithic villages throughout much of the world, tribal men who destroyed the nature religions and the world of the goddess. Today, in spite of the fact that the Bible was written from the perspective of men who lived 4,000 years ago, much of the West continues to accept and embrace its teachings regarding women. Gerda Lerner writes, Western civilization draws many of its leading metaphors and definitions of gender and morality from the Bible. Many still today believe in the literalness of these metaphors, forgetting that human consciousness has evolved and developed over the last 4 millennia. The Genesis creation account speaks of a God who created earth and women for the pleasure and benefit of men. This myth speaks of a God who gave ownership of the earth, its resources, and women to the human male. We find a story that tells of women being created from a man's body, giving male, rather than the female, the original life-giving power. In Genesis, we see that Adam named the creatures of the earth. In Genesis, God formed the beasts of the field and fowl of the air and brought them unto the man to see what he would call them. And whatsoever the man would call every living creature, that was to be the name thereof. In many religions and faith traditions, including those of the ancient Hebrew tribal people, the idea of naming is symbolic of sovereignty. It was an important and often mystical ritual, giving meaning and at times predicting the future. While God ultimately was the creator, through the naming ritual, he gave the power of meaning and structure to the human male. Adam was given ownership of the animals by God. We then see Adam naming the women, signifying, again, ownership and authority. In Genesis 2, it says, and the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called Eve, because she was taken out of man. The man's naming formula tells us, the woman shall be the man's property, for he was here by the act of God's creation, and by his own power of naming, defined his authority over her, which is integral and binding. The naming here not only is a symbolic act of creativity, but it defines women in a very special way as a natural part of man, flesh of his flesh, in a relationship which is a peculiar inversion of the only human relation for which such a statement can be made, namely the relationship of a mother to a child. The man here defines himself as the mother of the woman. Through the miracle of divine creativity, a human being was created out of his body, the way a human mother brings forth life out of her body. The man, understanding the miracle of birth and desiring the creative and life-giving abilities, has, through this myth, taken the original life-giving power away from the woman and bestowed it upon himself. If life came from a man, and if women were just a means of incubating the seed, then women were no longer to be valued and honored for their creative and life-giving abilities as they were in the Neolithic times. They were now seen as a needed possession. Some scholars have speculated that at this time in history, there was a change in the understanding of how life is created. Rather than the former belief of God providing new life to the women, a man not being part of the process, it appears to have changed to the belief that the male is solely responsible for life, giving seed to the woman who is just a womb to allow the seed to grow. In Genesis 1, it states, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." Even in the belief that Adam was to have dominion over the earth and given the earth for his use is the realization that Adam is now in charge of the world. He is not part of the earth. The earth was created to be used for his purposes. The world becomes the setting or the background for man, man being God's ultimate creation. In the second chapter of Genesis, it reads, "And the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it." While this verse can be understood as man needing to take care of the earth, the reality is that our earth managed very well without humankind for 4 billion years. The earth does not need managing, it needs honoring. The idea that earth and everything that breathes on the face of the earth was created for man includes women. We have in Genesis a very profound yet perhaps subtle description of why women were created. Genesis 2:18 reads, "And the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make and help meet for him." So why, according to Genesis, did God create women? First, the woman was created so Adam would not be alone, and secondly, she was created to help and assist him. This hardly describes a partnership of equality. The Genesis creation story describes a woman being born from a man for his pleasure. Just as the earth was created for the man, so too was the woman. While some reinterpret this story to be more compatible with our modern sensibilities, when we understand the belief of the men who created the myth, we can conclude that men did indeed believe women were created for men's purpose and pleasure. It is somewhat comforting to our modern way of believing to believe that these early people wrote a story suggesting women were created as equals, signified being taken from a rib. But in light of further understanding of these tribal people, it is clear that these men, as other tribal people of the day, did indeed believe women were created by God for man's purpose, as stated in Genesis. We'll just briefly cover patriarchy, because I think it's game on. Patriarchy can be defined as the manifestation and institutionalization of male dominance over women and children in the family, and the extension of male dominance over women in society in general. It implies that men hold power in all the important institutions of society, and that women are deprived of access to such power. Patriarchy did not spontaneously come into existence at the time of Abraham, nor has it been in existence since the inception of human. Patriarchy is a historic creation formed by men and women in a process which took nearly 2,500 years to its completion. Patriarchy began in the tribal nomadic groups, moved into the archaic state, and ultimately became the framework for political, religious, and economic power for most of the world. Intertribal alliances were established through the exchange of women. This arrangement strengthened tribes during times of warfare, but in addition, women provided children, which increased the size of the tribe. Writes Eisler, "Women themselves became a resource acquired by men, much as the land was acquired by men. Women were exchanged or bought in marriages for the benefit of their family. Later they were conquered or bought in slavery, where their sexual services were part of their labor and where children were the property of their masters. The more women a tribe could possess, the more members could be added to their tribe. Larger tribes meant more power, wealth, and greater ability to control others. Those who owned the means of production, those who owned the women, could dominate those who did not." In the Judeo-Christian tradition, it is suggested that patriarchy is the divine sociological order. However, the basis for the patriarchal system in every known society is actually an unwritten exchange of protection and resources given by the male for sexual services, children, and domestic service required from the female. Patriarchy was oppressive to the integral development of women. The exclusion of women from the public life and institutions of the various societies came to be an integral part of the religious teachings and rituals of the period. Just how profoundly these effects were felt, we are only beginning to understand. The traditional civilizations were shaped in the context of the unceasing toil of women, their servant status, their possession by men, and their role as pleasure givers for others. In all this, they were profoundly depersonalized, writes Thomas Berry. So where are we today? The legacy of patriarchy and a dominator society is still prevalent even today, 5,000 years from its inception. Although in some cultures and societies, there have been recent progress in understanding the damages of inequality and the destruction of our planet, there are still many aspects of male dominance that remain. In spite of the recent advances in the West, women are still objectified, marginalized, and minimized in our society. Women are still rarely represented in the leadership roles of our country, our economy, our judicial system, businesses, and most significantly, our religions. In the West, women most often release their family name and take upon them the name of their husband's family. There are still marriages performed today where a woman is required to commit or covenant to obey her husband. The LDS Church, as well as other faith traditions, continue to limit and exclude women in significant ways. Many still believe a man has special God-given rights, powers, and privileges to interact with deity and to act in God's name that women do not have. And for some, there's still a belief that women must follow her husband, who alone can follow Christ directly. And much of the Western world continues to take for granted our planet. Using the earth for our convenience, purpose, and pleasure while destroying it is the legacy of the belief that man has dominion over the earth. Today we experience not only genocide, but biocide and geocide as well. We not only are destroying each other, but we are destroying the very earth from which we were created. Biologists estimate we are destroying 10,000 species of life every year, a species every 20 minutes, creatures that will never return to our universe. We figured out by the time the Sunstone Conference has ended, there will have been 600 species of the planet that have been destroyed by the human. So, a new myth. For the last several thousand years, Western thinking has continued to cling to the biblical account of the creation, many believing in its divine historical accuracy. Yet some are beginning to realize the story was not significant as a historical, factual account of the creation, but rather as an attempt to answer the questions of life based on the beliefs and cultures of a time, a culture no longer existing in the modern Western world. Joseph Campbell writes, "The story that we have in the West, so far it is based on the Bible, is based on a view of the universe that belongs to the first millennium BC. It does not accord with our concept either of the universe or the dignity of man. It belongs entirely somewhere else. We have today to learn to get back into accord with the wisdom of nature and realize again our brotherhood with the animals and with the water and the sea. Over the last 10,000 years, the consciousness of the human has expanded from awareness of the tribal nomadic people to a connection to one's community and village, to a city and a state, and finally the nations. Is it time we can move beyond this to include peace and unity as a world community? Might we find a myth that moves us toward care and concern for our planet rather than ownership? A creation story that considers women as equals and shares the beauty of the feminine aspects of the cosmos. In order for our human family to continue, it is essential to embrace stories that will unite rather than divide. Stories that speak to the beauty and the uniqueness of all individuals, not stories that rigidly demand power, authority, and control. We need stories that honor women as they honor men with deep respect and equality, not stories that demean and perhaps even more hurtful, ignore half of humanity." Campbell writes, "We need myths that will identify the individual with his, not with his local group, but with the planet. We can no longer afford to embrace the belief that the human male must dominate and control the earth and women. We must find the balance and harmony that exists throughout the cosmos. We must embrace an ideology of a deep reverence for the earth and humankind." Berry states, "We need the religions of the world to understand the sacred community is the earth community. None of the spiritual teachings, none of the sacred books, none of the ceremonies and services will matter if we destroy our planet. None of the doctrines, scriptures, and rituals will be a concern if human beings are not alive to partake of their beauty. To preserve the natural world as the primary revelation of the divine must be the basic concern of religion. The well-being of the earth is primary. Human well-being is derivative." He continues, "None of our former revelatory experiences, none of our renewal or rebirth rituals, none of our apocalyptic descriptions are quite adequate for this moment. Everything is at stake." There are many well-intentioned men and women who believe that we can keep the current worldview, the current creation myth, and through more power and authority and control, humankind can overcome the difficulties our world is facing. There is the belief that it is God's will to limit the participation of women in the world. Some still believe the world was created specifically for humankind. It is my belief that the universe is requiring a change in our worldview. The world is calling for the influence of women in every area of life. The earth is crying out to be honored. It doesn't seem to be enough to keep trying to make the current worldview better through more control. Perhaps it is time for a worldview that honors the earth and humankind in all their beauty. It is essential to emphasize that embracing a new creation story does not mean we must destroy or suppress the cultural myths. It means we can understand them in a more expansive context. As all myths speak to the human journey, they are to be cherished and honored for the meaning and purpose they provided. By understanding myth as a reflection of the time and people of their creators, we can unite with our ancient ancestors as we discover their dreams and hopes and sorrows, questions and conclusions. Their myths can be seen as a reflection of the evolution of humanity and consciousness, stories that have provided structure and give a sense of purpose for millennia. We can understand their stories as the answers that gave them a sense of hope and significance while providing a foundation from which to live. They are part of our human history that is continually changing and evolving. So we can keep our cultural myths, as has been done throughout history, and embrace new knowledge and understanding as we create fresh stories that may provide more direction to our world today, direction which the world desperately needs. So is there a creation story that could unify our planet? Is there a story for our time, for the beginnings of humanity, reflect the understanding and needs of our time? A sacred narrative that would speak of a world family and teach an ideology of respect and equality, a myth that would bestow a reverence for nature and all of life. Cosmologist Brian Swim writes, "All societies throughout human history have rooted themselves in the fundamental stories of the cosmos. Out of their primal stories, humans define what is real, what is valuable, what is beautiful, what is worthwhile, what is to be avoided, and what is to be pursued." So just as the creation stories have come out of the earth and the sky in the past, perhaps as we enter the new millennia, we too can look to the cosmos for guidance and direction. What might the heavens tell us about our existence, our beginnings, and our purpose? After 15 billion years, as human beings, we have developed an awareness of the universe that has never been understood before on this planet. What is the creation story of today? It is not just a story about our origins as a species. I believe it is the story of the universe. Brian Swim, the physicist, he's a professor of mathematical cosmology. He most eloquently describes the origins of our universe as we understand it today. 15 billion years ago, in a great flash, the universe flared forth into being. In each drop of existence, a primordial energy blazed with an intensity never to be equaled. Thick with its power, the universe billowed out in every direction. After a billion turbulent years, the frenzied particles calmed themselves enough for the primeval fireball to dissolve into a great scattering, with all the atoms soaring away from each other into the dark cosmic sky, opening up in the beginning of time. In the depths of its silence, the universe shuddered with immense creativity necessary to fashion the galaxies. These gigantic structures pinwheeled through the emptiness of space and swept up all the hydrogen and helium into the self-organizing systems. Each galaxy presented its unique form into the universe. The most brilliant stars rushed through their natural sequence of transformation and exploded in colossal supernovas that matched a billion stars in luminosity and spewed stellar material throughout the galaxy. Some 5 billion years after the beginning of the star time it emerged in our spiral galaxy. It then scattered, sacrificed itself in a supernova explosion that dispensed its elemental power in all directions so that the adventure might deepen. 5 billion years later, after the universe had expanded and developed for 10 billion years, our Milky Way galaxy shocked a peacefully drifting cloud of time its remnants into giving birth to 10,000 new stars, one of which was our brilliant sun. Once granted existence, the sun showed itself in its own self-organizing abilities, blasting off nearly all the clouds of elements, yet hovering about it and spinning the rest into our solar system, creating our Earth. In the beginning, the Earth was a molten ball. Tons of water vapor came forth, and as the Earth cooled, the water vapor condensed and became the oceans. Our Earth, due to the balance of its own internal dynamics and its position in the structure of the solar system, came forth. Matter existed as solid, liquid, and gas flowing from one form into another to provide an incessantly creative chemical room from which the first living cells arose 4 billion years ago. From the first living cells, the prokaryotes came, oxygen, and then eukaryotic cells who created meiotic sex. Now creatures could not only replicate themselves, but they could unite two genetically different beings and fashion out of their genetic endowments a radically new being. Here we find the origin of the male and female. And then came the multicellular animals. Over the next 4 billion years, these small multicellular animals evolved and transformed into jellyfish, worms, insects, fish, reptiles, marsupials, whales, mammals, and apes, and most recently humans, who emerged just a few million years ago. The universe emerged and has gone through great events. Everything that has gone before us is required for this moment. 15 billion years of creativity. All these creatures and beings that have gone before us should be celebrated. The story of the universe is the new creation myth that we can embrace today. This is the story that resonates with many throughout the world. It is a sacred narrative that transcends gender and culture. It is a unifying story that speaks of the magnificence of God and life. It is a harmonizing narrative that can bring us a new awareness of our place in the universe. It is not a legend that is culturally specific, but it is a story that unites us as a world community and gives us a place within the developing cosmos. Just as the universe story may never have been understood in this manner, so too the sense of meaning, even the sense of the sacred that this story carries with it, is something new both in its modality and its order of magnitude. Former stories were mythic narratives dealing with an abiding pattern in the structure and function of the universe. This story incorporates the human into the irreversible historical sequence of universe transformation. So what does the story give to us today? What we may find as we embrace this new story is that the earth was not given to humankind to control and dominate. We came out of the earth. We are part of the story of the universe. The cosmos is our creator in a very real sense. It is the earth that transforms the sun's energy so we can live. It is the earth that gives us the diverse beauty and majesty in all its glory. Rather than believing it is something to be used and created for man's purpose, we can understand it to be a divine creation from which came all of life. We are an expression of the earth. If you think of ourselves as coming out of the earth rather than having been thrown in here from somewhere else, you will see that we are the earth. We are the consciousness of the earth. These are the eyes of the earth, and this is the voice of the earth. As we embrace the story of the universe, we will come to know that our planet is to be revered, honored, and supported, and tenderly respected. If we understand the new story of creation, we will know that women were not given to man as property for pleasure. Women and men evolved and developed in amazing and fascinating ways. While there are differences in all humans, we may not limit one gender because of the dictates imposed upon us by the beliefs of the Semitic tribal people thousands of years ago. We will begin to embrace the feminine energy of the universe in all its creativity and manifestations. We will not limit women to a singular role, but will enjoy her and honor her contributions in every area of life. The earth needs the balancing influence of the feminine. Speaking of the changes that may occur in society, Thomas Berry writes, "Beyond all this, and in a sense more encompassing than any of these, is the role of women in the future. The need presently is recognition of women and their capacity to interpret the human venture at its most basic level in the context of the universe and the planet Earth. The family, childbearing, and child-rearing will always be a central focus of human concerns, yet for women especially, a new range of their activities is needed for both themselves and for the larger destinies of the human Earth venture. We cannot do without those special insights that women offer in every phase of the human experience." In addition, we will not limit the role of men to that of provider, leader, or ruler, but we enjoy the influence of men as they are supported in the full range of their creativity and abilities, ways that have been restricted to them culturally and religiously. Some are already embracing the new creation story. More and more people are realizing that the ancient myth and biblical stories are not literal dictation from God, but a story of humanity. With the recent knowledge of the universe, humans all over the world are learning of the magnificent origins of the earth and life. This story is answering the questions that ancient myth is no longer capable of answering for humankind in the 21st century. Permeating the world seems to be a new, perhaps subtle acknowledgement of the beauty and life-giving properties of the earth. Humankind is just beginning to understand our relationship to the rest of the world. We are seeing the harm we have caused and are beginning to acknowledge the significance of the devastation. Throughout the world, there are women and men who are seeking a new hope for the earth and for life. There are many who wish to move beyond the confines, dictates, and boundaries of religion, belief, and gender to become a world community, celebrating diversity and cherishing the many forms of life and deeply honoring differences. Writes sociologist Lewis Mumford, every transformation of humanity has rested upon deep stirrings of the intuition, whose rationalized expression amounts to a new vision of the cosmos and human nature. I believe the universe is speaking to us. If we listen, we will hear its whispered message. The world is calling for compassion and respect for our earth and each other. We must find balance, harmony, and equality. We must allow the feminine energy of the earth to again manifest in its fullness. We no longer can afford to withhold rights and privileges and opportunities from half the population of the earth. We must cherish and honor the variety, diversity, and beauty of our human family, of our world family. Thank you.
I only have one basic major disagreement with Jenny's presentation, and I don't know if it's not just calling six of one and half a dozen of the other, because her presentation was really, really prominent in some of the material that I've been reading as well, the ideas in a presentation. My disagreement is I don't think we need to develop a new myth, because the old one is still viable. What we need to do with the old myth is to remember, in the true etymological sense of the word, remember, put it back together. Jen has shown how the differences between patriarchy and that ideology, and the differences between matriarchy and that ideology, if we could put them together, as Rhianne Eisler said in her book Chalice and the Blade, it's called a Gylanic relationship. But I think we're saying the same thing, so it's okay. That's a good thing. I don't want to argue with her. She's too smart. So, but I want to share two just brief ideas that, of all people, we LDS should really enjoy and embrace and realize. Now, there are various different types of ways to read myths. To read history, to read scripture. One is to literalize it, concretize it, and accept that as the fundamental description of reality. If you're that type, terrific, wonderful, go with it, that's fine. Other types say, let's look at this, I've been reading a lot of Carl Jung through the years, and he was big with archetyping. If that's the way you look at it, wonderful. I'm not arguing whether one is going to be right and one's going to be wrong. However you want to look at this, accept it. But I want to share two ideas. One from the Kabbalah, since I've been reading that quite a while, and another from the Gnostics' viewpoint that will help, possibly, I think, could help us in our psychology so that we here on Earth won't destroy our Earth, because this is where we live right now. We have no choice. We have to take care of this place. I'm from Idaho. Coming down into Salt Lake all my life has been a complete joy. I wish I had about pictures of Salt Lake Valley back when I was 6 and 7 and 8, coming down to watch conferences and all. The difference will scare the hell out of you folks. Salt Lake Valley has become dirty. The air here is amazing. It's like a fog. It shocks me. We can do better with our earth. Here's the two ideas. In the Kabbalah, they have a major paradigm. It's their tree of life. I don't know how many of you folks study the Kabbalah. I have a picture of the tree of life. You can't see it. I know my presentation's not quite that good, but you can come up and see this afterward if you're real curious. The Tree of Life has 10 different Sephiroth with 22 paths connecting them all. The way the Kabbalists dissect this thing is to either dissect it vertically or dissect it horizontally. The whole key to the tree of life in the Kabbalah is balance. If you get unbalanced, you know, they put weights on our car tires. If you drive down this interstate, this wonderful new interstate that this city has, lots of triangles. And these three sets of triangles have different representations. The uppermost, I'm just going to show you this way, the uppermost triangle of these three are the crown, wisdom, or chokmah. The crown is Kether, and on the other side of this triangle, on the other point, is Bina, or understanding. And the way the Jewish Kabbalists viewed this supernal, this uppermost, this most important triangle on the tree of life, was as a trinity. But it wasn't the Christian trinity of all male, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. In Hebrew, the spirit, Ruach, is feminine. In some Kabbalists' traditions, the Trinity is Father, Mother, and of course their offspring, the Divine Son. And with understanding that the Mother is considered the Holy Spirit in some of the Kabbalistic traditions that I've been reading, it gives a new touch on two aspects in the Bible I want to share with you. In the very beginning, back in Genesis, when the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. Now, the Hebrew word, merchefet, talks about hovering. The image, that's not a good translation. The image isn't right. It's not, it appears to me that it just would seem like it's idle over the water. That is not what is happening. The Mother, along with the Father, has been involved in creation, wisdom, in the wisdom tradition of the Jews. This is the Mother. She is now hovering over these waters. The image, the better image, is like a mother hen brooding over her chicks. She's flapping her wings, she's bringing her chicks under her, she's walking around. There's energy, there's movement. The Mother is involved in action, vibration, vitality. That's the image of this. It's a cooperative enterprise between the Father and the Mother to produce the creation. And what is the whole point of making all this stuff? What's the point of creation? Children. If you want to take that literally, fine. It's generation. It's improvement. It's increase. Now, another biblical image that brings in the Gnostics is at Jesus' baptism. At his baptism, he's in the water, he's been baptized by the Baptist, and we hear the voice of the Father from the heavens saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." That's a wonderful image. The Father is obviously happy with his Son's choices and actions. Then we read in the account that the Spirit came down in the form of a dove to Jesus. Now, one of the oldest, most venerated, most important Mother Goddess symbols is the dove. And from a Gnostic viewpoint, how I believe it's the Gospel of the Hebrews, it gives Jesus' perspective. And after he's baptized, he says in the Gospel of the Hebrews, "My mother came down, grabbed me by the hair, and lifted me up." Now, that's a metaphor. It's a metaphor, but the way the Gnostics understood this is that you have a wonderful image of the Father, the Mother, and their Son. Now, the psychology here, if you will, that I'd like to share with you is this. The Hermetic doctrine from the Tabula Smaragdina, the Emerald Tablet, one of the most famous tablets of the Hermetic tradition, which is basically back in the early Christian era, although the Emerald Tablet has come down through the medieval ages, the main tenet of doctrine is as above, so below. As it is in heaven, so it is on earth. So, the reason I bring these two traditions out, if we on earth would recognize this as above, so below, I don't care if you take it literal, I don't care if you take it archetypally, I don't care how you take it. If we understand that there's a cooperation in all aspects of creation and of keeping that creation alive and vital and working together, whether it's man or woman, we live in space-time. We have no choice at this point. Space-time involves opposites. That's what Lehi in the Book of Mormon says. There has to be this opposition in all things. Hot, cold, wet, dry. Male, female, up, down. Color, colorless. We live in the opposites. But that's not the state that has to be the fundamental reality. We can use those opposites. That was that wonderful image that Jenny showed with the yin-yang, that black and white swirl. That's a magnificent image. If you take even just the smallest dot out of either side, or if you take half that side out and say, I can do that with this much, you're fooling yourself. The whole point is a balance in motion and working together. It's the same principle with the Kabbalah. It's the same principle in the Gnostic tradition. It's the same principle in our faith. Whether we come out and completely elaborate it on or not is irrelevant. We know we have songs teaching we have heavenly parents. So if we believe that there is an equality, an eternal working partnership together in the heavens, because that's how it is, we might be able to adjust our psychology just a little bit, and instead of thinking who's the leader, who's the boss, who calls the shots and all that, forget all that noise. That's extraneous silliness. Work together and we can accomplish way more. Thank you. This is my time to say I went over, so if there are no questions, thanks, I'll sit down now.
We actually have 5 minutes for questions. I'd like to thank the presenter and the responder for an excellent treatise on the subject. Are there any questions? And if there are, I'll repeat them for the tape. Let's go with you in the back first and work our way forward.
Actually, this paper is actually about 4 times as mine. I have a really condensed it, but it's actually, I think that's a 75 reference.
That's
it's pretty long, but I can get that for you.
Kind of afterwards.
Yeah.
As I was listening, I guess I'm the male persuasion, and I kept hearing about all this feminine stuff, and I kept having to fight this. This reaction of, wow, I'm getting beat up on here. It gets me that masculinity needs to be redefined. Kind of going along with what you were saying. And I think, in a way, we have to redefine what it means to be strong.
Yeah. Actually, I did have that point covered in the final paper. I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, it really, for me, I believe it's all about balance. And like Carrie actually mentioned the same thing. And I think this paper was primarily focused more on the feminine. But I feel like equally damaging has been the fact that men have been restricted in what they can bring to our culture as well. And I personally feel as passionately about that as I do about women being able to expand their roles. I feel like there have been a lot of many, many years where men have not been able to influence their children in a caretaking way. I think it's changing now, and I'd love to see that. I see my little granddaughter with her dad, who is very much a caretaker, and I feel like it's so beautiful, and it brings so much to her life. She has two caretakers that adore her, as opposed to a few generations ago where it was only the woman. And I feel like she's just, it's so much more of a blessing for her. So thank you for bringing that up. I agree with you.
I think it's interesting that a lot of times when we have the history,
history of talking about protecting the earth and honoring the earth. And when I've really been thinking about it lately, the earth is going to survive. We just won't be able to live here. And I think we have a tendency to remove what we're actually responsible for. We keep saying what we need to be responsible for is honoring the earth and balancing out the earth, and that turns into this very symbolic thing. And I wonder what it would take and what a difference it would make if we actually started saying, can we honor our own ability to live? And what it takes for us to have life here. Because the earth has been through much more traumatic things than what humans are doing to it. And it's still been here. The whole process of getting to the point where we can live on the earth was much more traumatic. Mm-hmm. And so the earth would continue on, but we wouldn't. Yeah. And so would that make a difference? Where it's not so much honoring the earth, but reflecting it back on what we ourselves could do to live here.
Kind of change it from a selfless orientation to a selfish orientation.
Instead of geocide, we're committing suicide.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I thank you for bringing that up. One thing I have found in the research is, I had to leave this whole part out for this, but I went through a lot of the research that environmentalists have done and biologists about what's happening to the world, and there were several quotes that I found where many of the world's authorities believe that what we are doing to our Earth right today is worse than anything that has happened in the whole history of our planet, including the time of the destruction of the dinosaurs, because of our technology, because of our ability to use nuclear arms, that we are in a very precarious position. So yes, the Earth is going to continue in some form for several billions of years, and that's a good point, but I think I don't know that most of us really recognize what's happening. I know I didn't even until I started really doing the research, how crucial it is, and I had lots of statistics how little water we have available to us today. I think something like 30% of the water in our country we can't even drink, and we have so little available to fresh water anyway. I have somewhere just how much topsoil how much poisons we're putting into the into our water and our earth. And in fact, do you want to find that? Because it's very interesting. And I know, for example, the aquifers. This is something we've been poisoning our aquifers. It will take 100,000 years for the earth to be able to restore an aquifer, and we are poisoning them so much. And just every day, we don't even think about it. I know in terms of our topsoil, we're destroying it so quickly. It takes 1,000 years for the earth to create 1 inch of topsoil, and we're destroying 6 billion tons in America every year. It's phenomenal about what is actually happening to our earth. And I know we get so caught up in our own little worlds, and it's important for us what we're doing and feeding our families and just work, but I think it's also important to recognize what's happening too. So, but thank you. That's a really, really good point.
I have a question if nobody else does. Do you think it's possible as a God-fearing person to become alarmed enough to motivate us to action? And the reason I say that is I think the general belief is that God is in control. The whole theological framework is that God controls the earth, God controls the environment, God controls man. He moves nations, he destroys nations, he is the supreme ruler. So really, why worry? Because if it's happening, it must be God's will, and God will fix it. So why get worked up about it?
There's your answer, pal.
Margaret Wells did this morning, and just think even of how you posed that question. God did this. He is in control of man, which underscores the necessity of Jennifer's presentation. So, Margaret Wells did address that, of an echo theology.
Yeah. I think part of it, I saw a special on the Discover Channel, I believe, a little while ago, and it was on the melting of the ice caps, and because of our freedom to make our machines and go chasing that almighty buck, and the rich get richer, because of the way they've been doing it, the ice cap is melting at a rate thousands of times faster than they expected. Alaska this summer, I had a friend go to Alaska this summer, and they called back and said it was 103 degrees there. They said the rivers are running out of the glaciers from them melting so speedily. The carnival boat, the tour boat, has a completely different route now because the glacier has receded 11 miles in the last 10 years. God may be in control, but on the other hand, God leaves it to ourselves too. So, I mean, he made the creation, sure, but that doesn't nullify our free agency. God's in control, but somebody could walk through that door and start gunning us down, and there's God wouldn't stop them. That's the question of Job, isn't it? Why does evil exist in the world? Free will.
Just before we go, I just want to give you a couple of resources that I think every person in the whole world should know. One is The Universe Story by Thomas Berry and Brian Swim. Another one is what's my other one? Canticle to the Cosmos by anything but Brian Swim and Thomas Berry. I think they are exceptional. Those are the
Yeah,
The Universe is a Green Dragon is one, but those are maybe some beginnings.
Thank you all for coming.
Yeah, you know, in the moment of the